Hi, I'm Beta Hill, and this is the D-Word podcast, where we talk dementia. I'm always keen to keep up to date with new developments in research, and this week we're going to be talking about a new groundbreaking genetic test capable of predicting your lifetime risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And I'm delighted my guest will be one of the team who've pioneered it, CEO of Cytox, Richard Pither. So let's start by learning a little more about genetic testing.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Thanks very much for the opportunity to speak about the test. The genetics of Alzheimer's disease, as you may know, is actually very complex. There's a relatively unusual form, the early onset form of Alzheimer's disease, which occurs in, fewer than 2% of sufferers, but the majority is what we call late onset Alzheimer's disease, and the genetics is very complicated. In fact, our test spans and covers genetic elements over 112,000 different genetic components that spread across the spread throughout the genome that link to dementia risk. You may have come across before the so-called APOE or APOE gene, which is one component that people may be familiar with, particularly the E4 variant being risk associated, but there are many, many other genetic variants throughout the genome that are associated with altered levels of risk for developing Alzheimer's disease.
A lot of work in development is obviously necessary. I mean, the first thing we would like to develop a test, a genetic test, to give people an idea whether they might develop Alzheimer's in the future. I mean, where do you go from there? What's the kind of process in developing something like this?
Yeah, okay. Well, the basis of the test was developed in academic centres of excellence, primarily initially in the UK, members of the so-called Dementia Research Institute, which is spread across multiple university sites in the UK. The work really started with the efforts of the team at Cardiff University, led by Professor Valentina Escott-Price and Professor Julie Williams, working closely with University College London and Professor Sir John Hardy. And what they did was initially develop this technology, which we call polygenic risk score technology, or PRS technology, which essentially identifies those areas of the genome that are associated with a differential level of risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. And the way they did that, they was working with huge research cohorts. And we're talking about tens and tens of thousands of individual samples from people, on the one hand, with clinical Alzheimer's disease, and on the other, they're age-matched, cognitively normal individuals. And you do a DNA analysis, which essentially allows you to subtract, one set of variants from another to identify those that are disease associated. It's a process called genome-wide association studies, and it's been used in many different diseases to home in on those parts of the DNA of your genome, which are linked to disease. And we all carry pretty much the same DNA sequence, but we all have very subtle variants, and those variants can link to differential disease risk in the future. That's the work that underpinned the development of these so-called polygenic risk score tests. Okay, so Cytox got involved initially about 8 years ago through some funding from the UK government through an organization called Innovate UK. And what Innovate UK tries to do is match innovative companies and entrepreneurs in business with really good, sound, solid science. And that's what we did. And over the course of about 4 years worth of grant funding, we were able to take those initial research findings from the Cardiff University team with some input from Birmingham University and UCL, and turn it into a more comprehensive test. So actually, we started with a few tens of thousands of variants, and we're now today at a version of the test that's available, which actually looks at about 112,000 different variants across the genome, much more comprehensive risk assessment approach. And of course, what we have to do then is build the rigor into developing the product, following very well-defined product development guidelines before we can then take this into the market as a regulatory approved product. And in the UK, we have both a CE mark and a UKCA mark, which effectively denote the quality and the performance of the test, which allows us to promote it for clinical use. In the US, we follow a slightly different regulatory pathway called the CLIA guidelines, which allow us to offer the test as a so-called laboratory developed test, which we do in the US with a US-based partner.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
You're in June with the D-Word podcast. Well, my guest this week is Richard Pither from Cytox, and we're talking about the new genetic test to assess lifetime risk of developing Alzheimer's, which to me is another example of the emerging trend of people starting to take responsibility for their long-term health.
Oh, I think that there's a huge move actually on both sides of the Atlantic, away from treatment of disease, you know, so the kind of classic dementia center, to what we call brain health initiatives. So brain health centers, both in the US and in Europe now, in the UK. And the idea here is that you're appealing to a much younger cohort, a much younger and healthier age group generally, who may not have any symptoms at all, but are interested in taking action to prevent and reduce and mitigate the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease in the longer term. And I would say our test is really, you know, serving that population very well. And there are two main groups within it. There's the, you know, younger group who perhaps have had a family history, you know, if they've got parents or grandparents who they've seen experience Alzheimer's disease and dementia, and they want to understand whether they've inherited any increased risk. And if they have, they're prepared to make the lifestyle changes, the risk avoidance strategies that can reduce overall risk. So even in someone with a relatively high genetic inheritance, a tendency to develop Alzheimer's disease in the future, it's not a diagnostic test. I mean, these tests are saying you're in a higher risk group, so take these proactive steps, you know, more seriously and adopt, you know, more stringent lifestyle changes. And that message is resonating very well, and it's being supported by, you know, organizations around the world, the Alzheimer's Association in the US, the Alzheimer's Society and Alzheimer's Research UK, you know, here in the United Kingdom. So I think we're absolutely serving now that need. But there is another population as well, Pete, which are the individuals with early symptoms. They may have mild cognitive impairment. They may have anxiety, stress, and depression, which can, as you know, be forerunners and, you know, warning signs that you're at risk of developing the disease. And so these early symptomatic individuals are also being tested because it's been shown that even in that group, adopting healthy lifestyle and risk avoidance strategies can also have a very beneficial clinical effect. It can either stabilize or even reverse some of those symptoms associated with very early manifestations of dementia. So whatever your test result using polygenic risk score, there is something actionable at the end of it.
Yeah, I think it's a really, really important message that you brought across during that conversation. This isn't a diagnostic test because, you know, I guess if you get it back and you've got a high percentage, then, you know, that can lead to anxiety, can't it? People thinking, oh, no. But actually, this is more of an, oh, yes, there's still something I can do about it.
I think that's absolutely right. But we are aware that there is the possibility of causing anxiety. And so what we have as part of the test is the opportunity at the end of that process, when you get your test results, you know, whether they're high or low or wherever they might be, an opportunity to speak to a healthcare professional that can guide you through the interpretation of that test report and the actions available to you as a next step. So in the UK, we work with an organization called Minerva, who offer access to trained clinical professionals who will talk through results with individuals if they choose to do that. It's completely up to the individual with the test result as to whether they want to take that step or not. And in the US, where at the moment we only offer this test through healthcare professionals, so you have to go to a clinic to actually get the test, we are moving towards offering this as a consumer product. So the consumer can order the test, but it's overseen by clinical professionals. And at the end of the process, if the individual so chooses, they can book an appointment, you know, cost all included in the test price, with a genetic counselor that would allow them again to have that same discussion about understanding individual test results and the steps that that individual may want to take next. So, yes, I mean, we would argue that there's no bad news here. It is all about actionable outcomes. And of course, the landscape is evolving very, very quickly now. For the first time in 30 years, we've actually got the likelihood of a disease-modifying drug, a new treatment being approved initially in the US by the FDA, but ultimately, I think here in Europe as well, that will actually, you know, stabilize and reduce the rate of decline associated with Alzheimer's disease. And of course, I'm sure your listeners know about this drug, which has, you know, been in the you know, all the newspapers recently, called Leqembi, and being developed by Eisai and Biogen. Very promising data, and matched by a drug coming through a little bit later from Eli Lilly called donanemab. So, you know, the prospects for treatment now are so much better than they have been, you know, really ever. It's not going to be the end of the drug development pathway and activity for pharma companies, but it's definitely a bright new phase, I think, for Alzheimer treatment prospects.
I mean, suddenly we seem to, as you say quite rightly, it all seems to have come together fairly recently. I mean, is there a reason for that, or, you know, is there now more money in it, or, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, money has always been a problem. And because we've had so many failures until recently in Alzheimer drug development, the investment hasn't been anywhere near as high as it has been, for example, in cancer drug development, which is, you know, has dwarfed that going into Alzheimer's disease and dementia. And I think that's because it's been a very tough nut to crack. It's a really complex, multifaceted disease. And these new drugs actually work against a protein, a toxic protein called amyloid, to reduce the amount of amyloid building up in the brain. And that seems, if you catch individuals early enough and at the right stage of development, then it seems to have a beneficial effect. The kind of amyloid pathway, the amyloid hypothesis of Alzheimer's disease has been around for a long time. Probably about 30 years, but it's taken a long time to develop drugs that are effective, you know, against this particular target. Now, interestingly, one of the people I mentioned earlier, who's one of our close collaborators, Professor John Hardy at UCL, was really the discoverer of the amyloid cascade, the amyloid hypothesis of Alzheimer's disease, about 30 years ago, and has built his whole career on understanding that process and the genetics behind it. So he's been a very close ally of ours as we've developed this polygenic risk technology with John on the one hand and the team at Cardiff University on the other.
Yeah, I think it's an example of how important it is of those links of people involved with research that talk to each other and share the information. And I know, you know, you've given the example there and in other areas of Alzheimer's research. That seems to be a really good thing and something that the organisations do pretty well.
The resources needed to identify new targets for diagnostic or drug development purposes, is enormous, and it spans international boundaries. So I've mentioned the UK teams, but we've worked closely also with Professor Clive Ballard, who is now in Exeter and runs a global study called PROTECT, which has got tens of thousands of people being followed up over a long period of time, and that provides resources that we can use to tap in and understand the predictive ability of our test in the longer term. But we've also worked internationally, in particularly in the US with Professor Mike Weiner, University of San Francisco, who's been running something called the ADNI study, the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Study, for over 20 years now. And the resources and the ability to tap in and collaborate with people like Mike and many others has been critical in understanding the utility of our test and how it can be used, in the front line of dementia diagnosis and risk assessment. More recently, you know, we've been our test has been used now in U.S. clinics. More than 170 clinics are registered and able to use our test. And so we work with clinicians there to understand the patients that they're using and testing on a regular basis. So we continue to learn about optimized, applications and utility of our technology. But it's a very much, as you said, an international and collaborative effort.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to me, as I come from a public health background, and just thinking, thinking this one through from a public health point of view, this would be a brilliant tool to have. And let's start off with those people who may have a history of Alzheimer's in the family, et cetera, and roll out the tests. I mean, is there that sort of vision that, memory clinics, the NHS will join into this and roll out this kind of technology?
I think the NHS and the charities around the world and the research charities are still trying to pull together, that new paradigm. And I think the ambitions and the appetite for diagnostic and risk assessment is being transformed by the prospect of near-term therapeutic interventions available. So I think, I was speaking to people at the Alzheimer Research UK organization just last week, actually, and they're in the position of now developing a new position paper for identifying those at risk, observation and then intervention over a lifetime. So, one can imagine, and this is not policy by any means, but this is what the future could look like, where, everyone is tested at some point, let's say in their 40s, for underlying risk of developing dementia in the longer term. And if you identify those people at higher risk, then you can start focusing your resources and efforts on that group. So as we said earlier, genetics doesn't mean absolute diagnostic accuracy, it means a high risk group have been identified. So what you then do is you follow those people more regularly over every year or two with tests that will monitor changes on an ongoing basis. So you can use imaging based technologies or blood based technologies to understand whether or not the underlying risk is becoming apparent at the level of an active disease process. And if that is the case, then you can intervene much earlier, because these new drugs, these new treatments, and all these lifestyle interventions, the earlier you get into an individual who's at high risk and in the very early stages of the disease process, the more effective they will be and the more cost effective those interventions will be as well. So, these are exactly the new kind of policy paradigms that are being written up and prepared at the moment by people like the Alzheimer's Research UK group, and they will be used to influence the policymakers at governmental levels around the world, in fact, to implement these on the ground. And there are organizations that are working on a global basis. You may have heard of a group called the Davos Alzheimer Collaborative, who work, with governments around the world to implement best practice, in all healthcare systems, whether they're publicly funded like the NHS or privately funded by insurance companies, for example, in the US system. So, ensuring we spread best practice into all communities, however the healthcare is provided, I think will be a major, major goal over the next few years.
Yeah, I think it's a major way of there is so much negative still reported around dementia. I saw an article, I think it was on your website, from the US. The third of Alzheimer's cases are linked to 8 modifiable risk factors. And when we look at those modifiable risk factors, they really are. There are something we can do something about. And I think it's really important, that message that now starts to get out there, that this is something we can start to do something about.
There's work that's been published over the last few years, which I think has been some of the most important in our field, but it's still really not widely understood, even amongst healthcare professionals yet. And that is that these modifiable risk factors, and there are, you know, up to 12 of them have really been well, you know, under, you know, well validated and described. They can make the difference, you know, in about 40% of Alzheimer's cases. So 40% of Alzheimer's disease risk is modifiable. So that's why if you end up in a high risk category, those are the sorts of things that you can be doing and, you know, addressing on a regular basis. So, you know, first of all, I mean, treating comorbidities that are associated with Alzheimer's risk, which include type 2 diabetes, they include hypertension, high blood pressure, even include hearing loss. If you know you're in a high risk category, those are things you can get treated aggressively, you know, very quickly and relatively easily. But there are also other things which I'm sure, you know, you and your listeners will be very familiar with. I mean, social, you know, interactivity is really important. You know, remaining physically and mentally active and stimulated, you know, reading discussion groups, just seeing friends, cutting back a little bit on alcohol, you know, reducing smoking, things like that. These are all factors that have been shown in scientific research, much of which has been led actually by a very well-known Finnish researcher called Professor Mia Kipapelto in studies called the FINGER studies, which are long-term studies showing the benefit of these interventions. I think they've been absolutely critical, you know, in educating neurologists and specialists, dementia specialists, as to how to, you know, manage and reduce Alzheimer's risk. And that's why our test, again, I think is important, because we just need a saliva sample. There's nothing invasive about our test. We're not even needing blood, let alone cerebral spinal fluid, which, you know, some other tests actually have used in the past. So a simple saliva, you know, sample is all that's needed for us to extract the DNA and then run the test and give you this overall risk score. And then with that information, you're able to really home in. You can target the resources of the people who are really going to need it, really benefit from it. And as you said yourself, you know, there's a huge sort of economic benefit to that by, you know, not wasting resources on people that don't need it, but rather targeting them on the ones that do, and slowing down, reducing, you know, hopefully to a much greater level the numbers that ultimately will need, you know, very substantial resources in later life. So I think there's a huge clinical, ethical, and, you know, economic benefit to tests like these.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
You're in June with the D-Word podcast, where I'm chatting to Richard Pither from Cytox about genetic risk assessment, which is a form of technology that could combine perfectly with joint health messages, such as what's good for your heart is also good for your brain.
There is. I mean, anything that's good for your heart, you know, is pretty much guaranteed to be good for your brain. I mean, I think that is a simple and very, you know, apposite, appropriate message, really. You know, Alzheimer's disease is about reduction of blood flow and nutrient flow into the brain. And anything you can do to stimulate that is good. And hypertension, you know, is bad because, you know, you're obviously compromising, you know, blood flow through the risk of small strokes and damage to the small vessels, the vasculature in the brain. So anything that you can do to reduce the blood pressure in people otherwise who have hypertension, you know, is also a very beneficial thing. In fact, it's estimated that a lot of those beneficial effects that we've seen through more aggressive treatment of hypertension have translated into, you know, somewhat reduced risk of Alzheimer's disease and dementia as well. So, yeah, it's a really important link, and it's an important point that you make, Pete, that to think about your heart, you know, and the exercise and the activities you may do to maintain a healthy heart and a healthy blood pressure level will also benefit your brain in a very similar way.
Well, Richard, I think you've done a great job in, you know, if anybody was sceptical, persuading people this is a really good thing. Obviously, if there is somebody listening and they want to take the test, where do they go from here?
Well, OK, so if you're listening from the UK, this test is available directly to the consumer. We call our test GenoScore ACT. And you can find all about the test. There's lots of information on the web at wearegenoscore.com. So that's we are, one word, genoscore, GenoScore.com. And that will take you directly into the portal, and you can read all about the test and how you may be able to access it. In the US, the test is marketed by... under the name of the Alzheimer's risk test. And if people search for the Alzheimer's risk test, they will find links to that, and they can request information. They can talk to us as well, and we will direct them to a clinic in their own locality who are offering that test. Or alternatively, they can access the test via so-called telemedicine. So if you live in a location that's not convenient to reach a doctor that's providing this test, we work with an organization called Neuro2Go. That's Neuro, N-E-U-R-O, the number two, go. And you can talk to clinical professionals there who will be able to tell you all about the test and decide together whether or not it's appropriate for you. In the longer term, the next 2-3 months, we're looking also to make the test more available directly to consumers in the United States as well. So, you know, please look out for the Alzheimer risk test information that we put out on social media, on our website as well, and you'll be able to access that in due course.
Richard, thank you so much for being my guest. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I think it's a very exciting time, and a time where we might just start to see the beginning of the end for Alzheimer's.
I think it's a time when people can take proactive steps. The tools are out there, And people are motivated to do this. We know from our own research and others that, you know, people are looking to take control of brain health, and in the same way that they've taken control, as you said, of cardiovascular risks in the past as well. So I think the time is now to do that, and we're proud to offer the technology to support that.
Many thanks to Richard for a fascinating chat, and as he said, you can find out more about the new test and the subjects as a whole at wearegenoscore.com. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me again soon on the D Word Podcast.